More monthly payments to the IRS. Get ready to write this number down. It's the most important number you'll ever need to end your IRS tax nightmare. Call Paramount Tax Relief at 800-547-4804 for a free confidential consultation to find out if you qualify for the CNC tax program. Once you are accepted into the CNC tax program, you won't make any payments to the IRS while in this program. Call Paramount Tax Relief now at 800-547-4804. That's 800-547-4804. 4804. Again, 800-547-4804.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business. Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR-DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Good morning. This is Nicole Smith, and you're listening to Happy to Help on Hunterdon Chamber Radio. We're on Facebook Live today at Happy Hunterdon or Happy to Help. And very excited today to be talking with Melissa Von Stadi. She is a fundraiser. We worked together recently at the Princeton Community Works, where I moderated her special session on fundraising, and she's got a wealth of information to share. And so I'm just going to hand it over to you, Melissa, to kind of tell us a little bit about your background and what got you into fundraising.
Sure. Well, thank you, Nicole. This is so much fun. I'm happy to be here. And, you know, like so many people, I didn't start out wanting to be a fundraiser. I mean, nowadays, you know, some people really think of that as a career, but I really fell into it like so many did. And it's amazing to think I've been doing this for 37 years. I really have only done one thing in my life, and that's be a professional fundraiser. And so many people say, gosh, how can you ask people for money? And I said, you know, it's really rarely about that. It's about developing these incredible relationships. And it's a point of pride that I get to be kind of in the mix when people are thinking about their philanthropy and how they can make an impact and make a difference, and I get to be part of that. And I've just met remarkable people through the years, and it's so rewarding to go back and see projects, you know, buildings that didn't exist before, programs that didn't exist, and to see them thriving and to think I had a small hand in that. It's been so rewarding. But I really went to college to be a music and theater major. I was, you know, one of those kids that wanted to go to Broadway, and I thought, oh, I'm going to make it big. And then I was with kids who were really talented. In fact, Steve Carell was in all my classes.
No way!
To be honest, at the time, nobody thought Steve was that good. But what did we know? I was at Denison University, which has an incredible BFA in theater and music program. But I figured out pretty quickly I didn't have the drive. I may have had the talent, but I didn't have the drive. And so I switched over to be an English major. And in my sophomore year, Denison was in a capital campaign, and they were wrapping it up, and they were hiring students to do phonathons. And I just thought, well, that could be a good way to make money. And I ended up doing very well at that and becoming a student manager. And so when I graduated, a group of my friends and I, we were all moving to Boston. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was actually looking at teaching positions. And Harvard University at the time was in the last 2 years of their capital campaign, which, let's see, this was 1983, and the goal was $350 million, which at the time was the largest capital campaign for an Ivy League university. Of course, now they're $6, $7 billion campaigns. But the process is all the same, and they were looking to hire a phonathon queen, somebody who would come in and do all the general gifts work. And I thought, gosh, I've done that before. And this is kind of a funny story, but I had 26 interviews. I remember this.
Wow.
And which is typical for university. You meet a lot of people. And my boss called me in, and he said, Melissa, we just wanted to tell you we were very impressed by you. And, you know, you were one of our finalists, and we had a lot of candidates, and we really like you. But, you know, basically, I thought he was telling me, sorry, you got close, but, you know, we're not offering you the job. So I left, and I called up my father, and I said I didn't get the job, and, you know, can I come home for a week? And so I bought a plane ticket, and I flew home. And the very next day, this man chased me down. He said, what are you doing in Michigan? And I said, well, this is my home. And he said, but I offered you a job yesterday.
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that
so
funny?
So I had to go tell my father I'd gotten a job offer, and I didn't even know it.
That is bizarre, right?
It was very strange. And later, I did work for this man for 7 years and loved him and realized that it really wasn't me. He was a little obtuse at times, but
wow,
it was very funny. So that's where I started. I started at Harvard, which was an incredible training ground and just wonderful, wonderful experience, and met great colleagues and was fortunate enough to kind of knock on doors of, you know, at the time I think there were, I don't know, over 200 people in the office, and I would say, well, now what do you do? And can I come watch what you do? And Harvard was great because even though I was working mostly on the annual fund side, I got to sit at the table and talk about strategies for how to close big gifts, and I got to just absorb it and hear it and learn about the process.
Wow.
And I had one of my, I know you, you know, do you mind if I'm just rambling here?
Absolutely, go for it.
I have another great story for you at Harvard. I've taken the story and carried it with me forever because it was such a good reminder of what's called donor-centric fundraising, which is think about it from the donor's perspective. How do they want to be treated? How do they want to be, you know, communicated with and engaged? And I was working on a campaign for the East Asian Research Center at Harvard. And they had gotten a Mellon Challenge grant to, and they had to raise, I can't remember exactly, but $2 or $3 million to match this challenge. And time was running out. And they had an honorary chair of the campaign whose name was An Wang. You might remember Wang Computers, which were some of the first desktop computers and all. And he had given $500,000 to start this campaign to meet the match. And by the time I got involved with the project, it was not going well, and really no money had come in. And I said, well, you know, the first thing we need to do is write an update letter to the committee and let them know where we are and what our plans are and, you know, that it's stalled, but we're going to get going again. And I remember doing this letter. It was a Friday afternoon. I did the mail merge. I had them all perfectly done. And I was walking home, and I put the letters in the mailbox. And then by the time I got home, I realized I had mailed Dr. An Wang's his letter, which you don't do. Everything at that level had to be approved and signed off on, and I thought, oh, well, he'll never read it. You know, he's not going to read this little letter from me. And a couple weeks went by, and I was at my desk, and the phone rang, and a woman said, Melissa, this is the doctor's office calling, and the doctor would like to meet with you.
Wow.
And I had, and I said, well, I have to ask, which doctor is this? And she said, well, Dr. Wang. And I thought, oh no. So I went down the hall to the big boss, and I explained what had happened, and I just saw him turn bright red, and he said, well, you can't go to that meeting alone. You know, this was at the time one of Harvard's, you know, biggest donors and biggest prospects. And I said, no, I don't want to go alone. So I went with the director of corporate and foundation fundraising, and basically I was told, you know, now you just kind of sit there, and, you know, if any questions come at you, I'll answer them. I said, okay, I get it. So we drove out to Lexington, Massachusetts on Route 128. I'll never forget it. And we went into his office. And on his desk was my letter. And it was 2 pages. It was a memo. And there were red circles, red ink, red circles all over it. And I thought, oh, this is not going to go well. And he asked me a few questions. And I remember my colleague tried to answer for me. And he said, no, I'm asking Melissa the questions. And so I, you know, had to answer. It was my letter. So he looked at me and he said quickly, well, it sounds to me like things aren't going very well. And I said, you know, in my perky way, yes, but we have all these plans. We're going to get it, you know, back on the ground. And he said, well, here's how what I'm going to do. And he opened up his desk drawer, and he took out an envelope, and he slid it across the table. And I remember he had a great sense of humor, and he said, you can open it now. I didn't even know whether I should look in the envelope.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in the envelope was another check for $500,000.
Wow.
And he said, I want to help. You know, I want this to be successful. I have my name on it. I care about this project. I care about this program. And, you know, I was disappointed. I hadn't heard from anybody. And in reading your letter, I realized you guys need some help. So here's, and I've never forgotten it. Because,
wow,
you know, we think we have to go in front of donors when we have everything wrapped up in a bow and it's just perfect and neat and we, you know, everything's. And the truth is they want to get in the trenches with us and they want to help and they want to make a difference and they want to have an impact. And most importantly, they want the truth.
Absolutely.
And they want you to be authentic. And it was, you know, early in my career, it was a great life lesson and I've never forgotten it.
That is incredible.
Isn't that a great story?
Thank you for sharing that. I love that. Well, I think, you know, also, it just goes back down to communication, right? Because just to your point, you got offered a job and you had no idea. I mean, and it all comes down to human, because there's always miscommunications. Anyone who's married knows that it happens on a
right?
Or, but I mean, authenticity, honesty, you know, communication, and, you know, making your point clear. And I mean, that is amazing. There are so many things. Well, you talked before the show that your foray into philanthropy goes back farther than that, right? Mm-hmm. Through your
I did have great life examples through my parents, who were on every board. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and they were very engaged in the community. And I just thought that's how everybody lived. You know, my mother was on every committee. My father was on every committee. I saw them at night going out to meetings and hosting meetings. And that was just, I realize now, you know, what a terrific role model they were. And I have three older sisters, and they were all very engaged as well. And so that's been wonderful. But we had a tradition in our family where we went off to boarding school. And I was in the shadow of these three really remarkable sisters for years. And I decided the path I was going to take to kind of make myself known was be the difficult, disgruntled, too cool for school, somewhat of a mean girl. And I went off to a boarding school in Connecticut, Taft, and I thought I was just, you know, so cool. I really wasn't a very nice person. And my advisor, you know, one of the beauties of these boarding schools is they have these, you have adults all around you who aren't your parents, and they're watching everything you do. And they're really there to kind of hold you up and push you forward and challenge you and really make sure you come out a better version of yourself. And my advisor came to me early on, and he said to me, you know, you're just doing this all wrong. You're just blowing this experience. And I was, you know, didn't really care what he had to say.
You're a teenager, right?
Yeah. And he said to me, you know, what is our school motto? And Taft's motto is not to be served, but to serve. And I kind of said, I don't know, something about service. And he said, yes. And so we're going to get you, you know, thinking about somebody else other than yourself. And he said, meet me in the front circle, you know, tomorrow. And I said, well, I have field hockey. And he said, no, you're going to show up. And so I got on a bus with a group of students, older kids who I didn't know at all. And we went into inner city Waterbury, Connecticut. And we worked in an after-school program, all boys, in what felt like a very dilapidated gym. And I got paired up with this young boy, and we went over and we were supposed to be helping him with his homework. And he had a sheet of math problems, and we were supposed to do these 100 math problems. And it felt like an hour before he'd done 10. And I thought, I am never going to get through this. And I had a deck of cards with me, and I happened to know some great card tricks. And so I said, you know, if you finish the next row, I'll teach you a card trick. And by the end of it, I think I had 10 boys around me, and we were laughing, and we were doing these card tricks. And he walked me back to the bus, and he was holding my hand, and he said, are you coming next week? And I said something like, no, I have field hockey. He said, you know, what must that have meant to him? And I got on the bus, and I went back to school, and I didn't think much about it. And my advisor found me that night in the dining hall, and he said, you know, what'd you think? How'd it go? And I said, it was okay. You know, I was just so not ready to embrace anything. But over the course of the next week, I thought about that boy a lot. And I thought about, you know, how much fun I'd had. And I really wanted to go back. So I did. And I went back again and again and again and again. And, you know, that whole wonderful Gandhi quote, you know, if you want to find yourself, lose yourself in service to others. And that's what turned my life around. And I ended up, you know, chairing the service program.
Wow.
And, you know, it has been part of my life ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I feel in a rut, or I notice that, you know, I'm feeling bored or uninspired or what have you, I say, you know, I try and kick myself in the pants and say, come on, you've got everything going for you. You need to get out there and do something for others. And it's, you know, it's been really a hallmark of my life. And now I have these wonderful two daughters, and they've really picked that up, and we do a lot together, and it's wonderful to see.
I love that. I love the story. I love, it's so true, especially today when, you know, people are restricted and they're bored and they're hurting. There's a lot of people that are hurting a lot worse, and all you have to do is kind of look around and say, you know, what can I do to help? And it just turns everything around, right?
Yeah.
So amazing. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back. Sure.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
You're listening to HunterdonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located at the historic Large House, 119 Main Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programs.
Good morning. This is Nicole Smith. You're listening to Happy to Help on Hunterdon Chamber Radio. And today we're talking with Melissa Von Stadi. She is an amazing fundraiser with a background with different universities and schools and private schools. And where she was saying it's all about relationships. But I wanted to talk about this book that I read called No One Dreams of Being a Fundraiser. And this is a cute little book I read a couple years ago. And I think, you know, when you're young and you're thinking, well, what can I do with my degree or my life? You think, you know, what if it's not fireman or policeman or investment banker or teacher? There's so many other things, and fundraising is an amazing career. So if you can talk to your experience as being a fundraiser when you never thought you would be, and how it's still an amazing career today.
I love that title. I'm gonna have to get that book. I haven't read it. I hope more people do dream of becoming a fundraiser, because there's so much to this career. And we don't just ask for money. There's just so much other parts to it. And I've been fortunate in that I've taken a very twisty and turny path. So I started in this big development office at Harvard and got great training. But my job area was very defined. And I took a job. I thought, okay, now I need to get into major gifts. I took a job at a hospital in Boston, and within a month I knew I'd made the worst decision of my life for lots of reasons, which I won't go into. And I called my boss at Harvard up, and I said, you know, I think I've made a terrible mistake. And he said, well, quit. And I said, well, I've only been here a month. And he said, you're miserable. Cut your losses and come work for me. I've got a project I'm working on, and I'm the consultant to a large reform temple in Boston, and why don't you come help run their campaign? And I said, what is a temple in Boston going to want with me? And he said, you need to learn how to do something from soup to nuts, and I'll help you. And so I got in on a three-day-a-week basis. I ran a $4 million campaign. But I was doing everything. I was writing the case statement and, you know, recruiting volunteers and training volunteers and making asks and working with the rabbi. And it was such a great experience. I was just thrown into it. And then to fill out the other couple of days, I started to be a consultant to small independent schools in the Boston area. And this parlayed into me having my own consulting business for 8 years.
Wow.
At the same time, I got married, I had 2 kids, and it gave me tremendous flexibility. And then after a while, I realized I was kind of stale. I hadn't really learned from another person. And there was always that fear that if something happened to me, these clients had nobody to turn to. So there was a phenomenal consulting firm in Boston called the Wayland Group, and it was a small boutique consulting firm, very, very hands-on, very creative and strategic. And the head of it, a guy named Jim Kittendoff and his wife, I went to him and I said, would you ever take me on? So we merged our practices, and I became a vice president at the Wayland Group. And we would have, you know, 13, 14 clients at any one time. And so I was able to work on schools and hospitals and social service and arts organizations. And it was fabulous. I loved it. But it was exhausting because we would meet at a 7:30 a.m. breakfast meeting on the North Shore of Boston, and then we'd be at the South Shore of Boston at 8 p.m. at night for a volunteer meeting. Meanwhile, I'd run home and, you know, throw some chicken nuggets in the oven and sit down and have, you know, dinner with my kids. And so it got to a point where I thought, you know, I think I need to slow down. And there's a point to this story, which is there's so many opportunities in this field to be in a big shop, to be in a small shop, to work in a very defined job, to work in a job where there are only three other people and you're wearing many hats and doing it all. Mm-hmm. And I haven't met as many careers where there's such diversity to the work and to the day. And I discovered about myself, I thrive in that environment. I like to juggle lots of balls. I like to have things thrown at me. And I talk with a lot of women in particular, young women, about this career. And it's one of these careers that really play to women's strengths. The interpersonal skills, the writing, the interacting with donors, some of the financial acumen, some of the creativity, the marketing aspects of it, some of the detail-oriented nature, the follow-through, the keeping the spreadsheets and the tracking. And there's so much to it that I've met a lot of women who really feel that this is something that really strikes them and plays to their strengths. At the same time, there's great part-time work. There's great consulting work. I stepped out of the workforce altogether for 4 years and just was a stay-at-home mom and was able to come right back at a very senior level when I moved to Philadelphia and went to the University of Pennsylvania. So I was able to step right back in as a director of development for the Morris Arboretum, having really not worked for 4 years.
Wow.
And then I moved to become the dean of advancement at the veterinary school at Penn, which was probably my dream job and really was the most rewarding, the most challenging jobs I had. And then I discovered that I really wanted to get back to a level of education where I was around kids. And so I left, and I, after 10 years at Penn, and I went to the Petty School in Hightstown, New Jersey, and I was their assistant head for development for 5 years. And now I'm, you know, working as the director of development at the Pennington School for 3 days a week, and I've got four other clients and helping other nonprofits. And working about 60% time, which is just perfect for me right now in my life. And so you see, there's just been lots of opportunities to kind of fit the work around the lifestyle and make sure I, you know, could be the best parent I could be. And, you know, at the same time, I was taking care of some sick parents. So this is a career that really fits into a lifestyle, and it can be very rewarding and very meaningful. At the same time, I've worked through two major recessions, and probably 2007, 2008 being the most significant of them. And, you know, typically the director of development or the development officer is the last person to get laid off in a recession. You know, they're the profit center. They're the ones that are helping to bring in the money for the bottom line. So I feel like the career is somewhat recession-proof, and that's very helpful. And there's just lots of good work opportunity out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a great career for anybody who, you know, really loves. You know, first and foremost, you're passionate about the institution. You're excited to advance it. You're excited to move it forward. You find meaning in the mission, and you really love that part of it. And then, you know, there are the technical aspects of the job that are also rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. And I come from a business background, and then I took time off to have my kids. And then I've always done volunteer work, but then I found Room to Read, and I was able to use my creativity and some of my sales background and whatever, and just have fun with it. And it wasn't the PTO, and it wasn't demanding, and I didn't have all these meetings. I could just do it on my own time.
Right.
Do some posting, do some research, read some books, and, you know, but my whole thing that's drawn me into it and what I've always loved is I just love to talk to people. So that's why I'm here.
Right.
You know, and if you love to talk and you love to stories and you love to interact and you love relationships, like that's what I've loved about it. And I've learned so much along the way. Yeah. So I call it my 2.0. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody's thinking about, well, yeah, maybe I will consider this a career. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you feel suggest volunteering for an org first, or you can't just jump into a director of development job, right? So how would you funnel into that?
Right. Well, there are some very good survey courses, and the Association for Fundraising Professionals have a very strong certificate program. I would also look at local community colleges that also offer some of the basics in nonprofit management that's useful. This field is so open to networking. And in most cities, there is something called a Women in Development chapter. So if you're a woman, you can go to their programming. And I would look at institutions that you're really interested in and reach out to either the director of the annual fund or perhaps the director of development and ask for an informational interview. And go find out, you know, what's a typical day like? And what do they love about their job? What's the most challenging aspect of their job? And how did they build their career and where did they start? And, you know, particularly on Indeed.com and other places like that, you'll find tremendous numbers of jobs available. The Chronicle of Philanthropy, another great listing. CASE, which is the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education, CASE.org, is a great place to go and look for jobs, particularly in education. NAIS, which is the National Association of Independent Schools, they have a great job listing. Pretty much every state has an NJ. In New Jersey, it's NJAIS, which is the New Jersey Association of Independent Schools. So, you know, that's another market. The hospitals and the healthcare organizations are other great places to look. So, but get out there and meet people who are doing this work. Find out how they built their career. What does it mean to be a prospect researcher? What does it mean to be a grant writer? What does it mean to run a special event? What does an annual fund director do?
Right.
You know, these kinds of things.
Well, and also there's a whole set of terminology just with any
there
profession,
is,
like
right.
the Board of Trustees and like the acronyms.
Correct.
And what. So, I mean, that was something that I learned, you know, I'm like, oh, well, this means this and this, you know, it's kind of, there's a lot of crossover between the nonprofit and the business world.
Right.
But the one book that comes up over and over that's really good is The Soul of Money by Lynn Twist. So, that, I mean, that's just a great book, period.
Yeah, right.
Are there any other books that you...
This one, I think, is still in print. It's by Gerald Panis. It's called Mega Gifts. And
no,
it's,
Jerry Panis is like the godfather.
Yes, right. Yes. So that's a great to kind of understand what is major gifts and what does that mean? And then there are kind of two tracks in fundraising. One is the frontline fundraiser. So that's the person who's out on the front lines, meeting with donors, meeting with volunteers, managing volunteers, making solicitations, closing gifts. And then there's really the support field, and that's, you know, might be advancement services, which is running the database and doing reports and acknowledgement letters. Stewardship. You heard me say this at the conference. I am such a believer in what we do after the gift is more important than what we do before the gift to keep our donors close to us. How do we thank them? How do we report to them? How do we tell them and show them the impact of their gift? And, you know, it's such a competitive landscape now that, you know, donors are going to stick with organizations where they feel like they're really a stakeholder and they're appreciated and they have constant communication. So that whole field of stewardship is really burgeoning, and that's an important area. Research is another side. Writing, communications is another side. So all of these are, you know, incredibly important to the work. But there are people who, you know, don't really want to be on the front lines, but they want to be helping to plan an event or write the thank you notes or write the annual report or what have you. And, boy, we need those just as much.
Yeah, and I noticed, I don't know if it's just because I'm in this certain age group or if it's become more popular, but it seems like all of my peers are like, well, I want to be on a board.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and there's more to it than just being on a board. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's become more popular just from my perspective or it's just people of a certain age are looking to get more involved. But,
right.
And you talked about the different places for being on a board, whether it's emeritus or advisory or committee. So if you, there's different ways to jump in that way as a
Well, as a volunteer, I think you want to first, you know, really connect with an organization that speaks to your heart and find out, you know, what are they doing? What are their plans? How can you be helpful? oftentimes people first get involved through an event, planning mm-hmm. an event or an attending event, or on a committee level. You know, maybe you get on the development committee or the marketing committee, or you bring legal expertise or something of that nature. So you get to learn a little bit more about the organization, and they get to learn a little bit more about you. And, you know, most people are leery of that person who comes out of the woodwork and says, well, you know, I'm going to give you a big gift, so now put me on your board. Yeah. You know, that rarely works.
Yeah.
It's really about, you know, do you have a connection and an affinity for our work? Are you deeply involved here? Are you ready to roll up your sleeve and get in the trenches and help us through some of our, you know, our tough challenges? And you know, the best donors are ones that not only lead with their heart, but they lead with their mind, and they have a lot to offer in the way of advice and creativity and support, and not just, you know, opening up their wallets.
Mm-hmm. And then I think advisory committees are a big mm-hmm. thing now, and
exactly.
those are just another little enclave mm-hmm. of people mm-hmm. who are have expertise mm-hmm. to offer, right?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge with advisory committees is making sure you use them appropriately and that they don't kind of just stand on the wings and falter. You know, there's this old adage about volunteers are either misused, confused, or underused. Mm-hmm. And so volunteer management takes a lot of time and a lot of thought. And so, you know, you don't want to bring somebody in who could be really impactful for the organization and have them sitting there saying, I don't really know what this advisory board does. And, you know, what is my role here? And this is really not very meaningful for me. And so be careful about those advisory boards. You know, when you do put them together, and they can be very effective forms of engagement, make sure you're communicating with them. They're clear what their task is. They're clear what's expected of them. You're staying in touch with them, and that it's a meaningful experience for them.
Yeah, and you've talked about these major million-dollar gifts and major donors, and you've definitely been on the high end of academia and different things. Like, have you had any experience through your consulting or other working with, you know, grassroots nonprofits struggling, you know, because mm-hmm. it's, when you said wearing many hats, you know, it's hard mm-hmm. to be the volunteer manager, the director of development, and the program, like, you know, mm-hmm. ideally those are all separate,
right.
but
right.
you know, some of these people are struggling, and they just, but you know, you gotta have some money coming in the door. So what do you think is the biggest fear or thing that people do wrong when, mm-hmm. when they approach fundraising from a kind of a grassroots level or just starting out?
Well, the hardest things for organizations that don't have built-in constituencies, like grateful patients, alumni, current parents, you know, where they already know who to go to first and tap into. You've got to go out and find your prospects.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know, that is the hardest thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where arts organizations, you know, have to struggle, and social service agencies, et cetera. And the most important thing, and I think we don't do this well enough, is to first take a really look at your donors and make sure that the people who are already giving to you are really cared for, informed. You know, I said that, you know, in every job I've had a list on my desk of the, you know, top lifetime donors. And, you know, and I go down that list and I say, okay, what have we done for these top 10 people? What have we done for the next 10 top 10 people? When did they last hear from us? How have we reported to them? Have we said thank you enough? And so, you know, the thing you want to do first is really make sure that the people who are already with you and have already expressed their support, that you're really caring for them and you're not losing them, because it's so much work to acquire another donor and in that role.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure you're taking care of that first. Secondly, make sure you're spending some money on marketing. It is very hard to raise money in a vacuum. And if the general public has not heard about you and doesn't know about your work, and there's not a strong impact report on your website, or, you know, articles in the newspaper, or, you know, opportunities to really show the work that you're doing in the community, how are you going to garner attention?
Mm-hmm.
And so that whole top of mind name recognition, you know, you're out in the supermarket, you're hearing about an organization. What you don't want to have somebody say is, God, I've never heard of them. You know, it's very difficult to raise money in that environment. So make sure alongside your fundraising budget, there's also a budget for adequate marketing. you know, newsletters, annual reports. Make sure your website is as strong as it can be, because so many of our appeals and our communications are driving people to our websites. Mm-hmm. And then when people get to the websites, the information is outdated. Mm-hmm. It's not interesting. There's no compelling stories. We're mm-hmm. not highlighting the work we do in a compelling way. And so people, you know, are spending 15 seconds on the homepage and forming an impression. And if that impression isn't strong, you're going to lose them.
Right. So it all goes back to communication, right? Again,
mm-hmm. It does.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we talked about this at the Princeton Community Works, and I'm also doing a session on this at an upcoming panel for the Nonprofit Changemakers Summit coming up in March. And we talked about being able to effectively convey your message that of your what your mm-hmm. nonprofit does, whether you're a board member, a staff, a development
Correct.
Director, or a volunteer,
mm-hmm.
or a
Correct.
Donor. You should be able to effectively converse in a casual way mm-hmm. and convey what mm-hmm. your nonprofit does. So the elevator speech. So you have
right.
some great advice for that.
Well, and you know, you have to remember that every donor, and think of yourself when you're getting, you know, you're learning about a new organization. You have these threshold tests in your mind about, you know, whether this is an organization that's going to capture your attention and maybe you're going to make a gift to. And some of that is, you know, tell me about the what distinguishes this organization. What is their core programming? What are they doing differently? What are they winning at? So that's really important. How do you talk about yourself in such a powerful way that, you know, this is what distinguishes us and what we're good at? And that starts to get the heart engaged. Secondly, try and answer this question of, if we disappeared tomorrow, what would be the cost to society? You know, it's that big why question. Why do we matter? So societal relevance. You know, what is the big societal problem that you are working on and addressing? And that's really that very high level, why do we matter? Really important. And what happens sometimes when volunteers start to make the case for their organization, they quickly get into, yes, and we need a new building, and, you know, our building's falling apart, and if we don't raise enough money, we're not going to have a permanent home, and we're really, you know, working hard at a building. It's like they've skipped over all that important part. So if you get people's heart engaged in their mind, and they know that if, you know, this is the work you're doing and it's so key and it's so important and you're successful at it, so you've got to kind of convey the history, the longevity, the stability of the organization, the leadership of the organization, the distinguishing features of the organization. And once you've covered all of that, then you can get into our exciting plans and vision for the future and why we want you to partner with us and really be a stakeholder and help these visions become a reality. But oftentimes people get too quickly into the ask and they skip over all that really important part that checks all the boxes on the threshold tests.
Right, and that yeah, that's so many things that your organization does, and you're doing all these great things and you have all these programs, mm-hmm. but you can't condense that down into 30 seconds. So you have to pick and choose what you're going to talk mm-hmm. about, why you're mm-hmm. going to talk about it, and practice.
Right.
Right. You
exactly.
can't just, you have to practice. Practice right. makes perfect, especially
right.
in a conversation
yeah.
because you can't be like, it's like, where do I start?
You're right. And if you're running a nonprofit or you're serving on the board of a nonprofit or you're chairing a board or you're on the development committee, don't assume that every board member knows how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, make sure they've got the talking points, they've got the bullet points, and they're, you know, I suggest at every board meeting, you know, two members sit up and they actually get in front of the others and they do a role play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're at the supermarket, you're at a cocktail party, you just ran into your old friend and she asked what you're doing. How do you kind of walk through this exciting vision for this organization?
Right, and another good point you made was that if you're watching these other people talk about what they like about it, and you're like, oh, I never thought about it that way, and I love the way he phrased
right,
that,
exactly.
and, you know, I'm going to use that. So you can totally cheat and copy and share.
Exactly.
And,
right? Exactly.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, mm-hmm. I try and work Room Treat into the conversation within, like, 2 seconds, no matter what I'm talking about. But,
right.
But, yeah. No.
And I say this all the time. Not every board member has to go out and ask for a gift. But every board member needs to be an ambassador and know how to talk about the organization and in a really powerful, compelling way, and to really express their passion. And that's their number one role, is to really be an ambassador and spread the news about the great work.
And it shouldn't be that hard. Like,
no.
Yeah, they're already invested, but you do need to practice because not everybody's a stand-up comedian or a conversationalist
right.
or whatever, but you really, right. it takes a little bit of time just to hone that. And
it's sometimes at these meetings we get right into the agenda. You know, we're looking at the financial reports. We're talking about this problem or that problem. And there always needs to be some kind of programmatic component so that people get empowered and engaged again.
Yeah, no, I think that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take another quick break, and we'll be back.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
For over 50 years, Hunterdon Medical Center has been a leader in delivering comprehensive medical and health services to our community. Our staff is committed to providing the highest quality of care to our patients. If you need a physician, we can refer you to over 300 of the best. Call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org. When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
Good morning. This is Nicole Smith. You're listening to Happy to Help on Hunterdon Chamber Radio. And we're on Facebook Live today at Happy Hunterdon or Happy to Help. And today we're talking with Melissa Von Stadi. She is a fabulous fundraiser with so much incredible experience and has given us all kinds of great tips so far. And she not only is an expert in fundraising and talks the talk, but she definitely walks the walk. And so she's going to share several stories about the organizations that she volunteers with personally and is focused on.
You know, I think like so many people, we get drawn to really great causes because we meet somebody involved with them and their personal passion or their leadership just inspires us. And we just say, you know, I've got to get involved with that organization. And so for me, it's always been the people behind the organizations that have kind of drawn me in. Right now, I'm working on two projects locally. One is a charter school in Trenton, New Jersey, called Foundation Academies. Mm-hmm. It's a K-12 charter school, and what's unique about this school is that all the kids get there by lottery. Mm-hmm. So they don't take a test to get in. They're not the brightest of the brightest. It's literally a lottery. And what was remarkable to me is that 100% of their seniors go on to four-year colleges. And, you know, the challenge is to keep them in college and to help them and support them through that. But they've just been having extraordinary results, and they're looking to open up, you know, another school. And so I was so moved by the executive director of the organization, and I had a tour, and I saw these kids, and I go over and read to them now, which I love, and I'm on an advisory board there. And what keeps me coming back are the people. You know, I just, every time I'm over there, you just walk away thinking, how can I do more? How can I do more? And particularly having worked in, you know, really remarkable schools that have extraordinary endowments and lots of, you know, resources, it was really meaningful to me to be doing something in my backyard and with a school that's really winning. So that's been great. I was at my church, And I saw a presentation by the founder of a program called the PD Green Program, and it was all about really looking at the criminal justice system and understanding how incarcerated adults really have no opportunity to break the cycle and get real educational opportunities so that when they get out of prison, they can really get good jobs and move on with their lives. And so this program takes 600 university students in, I think, 12 different cities in this country and trains them to be tutors, and they go into the prisons and they work alongside incarcerated adults and help them get their GED equivalents.
Wow.
And so that when they get out... And what struck me about this program, it was founded by some members of the class of 1958 at Princeton University, named for Petey Green, who was a remarkable individual who came out of prison and went on to do amazing things in Washington, D.C. And I went home that morning and I thought, I know nothing about our criminal justice system. I never think about it. It doesn't touch my life. And yet it is just this huge problem in our country. And so I really rolled up my sleeves and started to study a little bit and get engaged. And this is one of the most meaningful things I've been working on close to home. Unfortunately, with COVID, you know, the students haven't been able to go back into the prisons right now, but they will. And if you hear from these college students and the work that this has been for them, it's that transformational experience like it was for me in high school. So that's been just terrific. And I love doing that. But the thing I've been doing most in the last 15 years is I met a woman who was originally a missionary in Honduras and ended up falling in love and marrying the Episcopal Bishop of Honduras. Mm-hmm. And she was so appalled by the condition for women in this, what is really considered to be one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. And, you know, there were 63 orphanages in Honduras for men or co-ed, but nothing for young boys or co-ed, but nothing for girls.
Wow.
And so about 15 years ago, or maybe longer now, she founded, over 25, she founded the first orphanage for all girls in San Pedro Sula, which is the second largest city in Honduras. And the program's called Our Little Roses. Mm-hmm. And so I was so taken with this woman. And because I'm the youngest of four girls and I have two daughters, I thought, I gotta go. And my family, my parents in particular, said, please don't go to Honduras. And I said, no, we're gonna do it right. We'll be safe. And I took my two daughters, who were at the time in fourth grade and sixth grade, and we've been going back ever since. Mm-hmm. And I just went down November of 20, and surprised a little girl that I've been really close to since she was 9 years old, and she was having her quinceañera. And, you know, she is the product of two gangs, rival gangs in Honduras, and fortunately, the equivalent of the Department of Social Services pulled her out of a really bad situation and brought her to the home. And she's now going to graduate university. She speaks fluent English.
Wow.
And so most of these girls have been taught in English in the American system, and they're going to go on to university. Some have become lawyers and dentists and doctors. And you know, you talk about changing the cycle of poverty and making a difference. And there are people who know me and know how passionate I am about this, and they say, but you lived in Philadelphia, you live close to Trenton, there's so many problems right here in your backyard. And I always say to them, you know, this is not an either or. You know, this is an and. We need to do it all. And, you know, you need to find something that really speaks to your heart, where you feel like you can make a difference, and stick with it and get engaged. And obviously you get more than you give. But it's been wonderful to do this with my daughters, who are now, you know, they go down without me. And I've been able to take some of my sisters down, and it's been a remarkable program. And to see these girls grow up and go on and do great things. Unfortunately, with COVID, they are all living behind a brick wall, you know, really for over a year now. Uh-huh. And they're doing all their schooling online. And it's been, I mean, Honduras has been hit not so just so tragically by COVID, but by two hurricanes. And the country's just in really terrible shape. So I don't know when I'll get back there, but certainly think about it all the time.
Yeah, and just even being there, it's totally different, right? Just
Completely.
Do you have any little stories to share of when you first got there, or what you noticed, like the stark difference between Jersey and Honduras?
I took one sister who... You know, her husband basically, I think, was about to divorce her because she came with me. But she came because her daughter was going to go down there and spend a month with my daughter. And she said, well, I better go see this place.
Aww.
And so we went from landing at the airport in San Pedro Sula to a kind of the equivalent of a strip mall where they had a Wendy's. And when we got out of the van, everybody in the strip mall had an AK, machine gun strapped over them. And I don't even see them anymore. Yeah. I'm just so used to it. And her eyes were just as big as saucers. And we got to the home and she sat on the edge of my bed and she said, "Well, we have to leave." I said, "Leave?" She said, "I don't feel safe here. Let's check into the Hilton." I said, "You know what? I think we're better here." And we went to church the next day, and one of the Tias brought over this new little girl in the home and just thrust her into my sister's arm. And this little girl was 6 months old. You would have thought she was a baby. She was so malnourished. Aww. But she was 6 months, and my sister loves babies. Aww. And she held this baby, and I thought, okay, we'll see where this goes. And by the time 5 days later it was time to leave, I couldn't get her on the van. She was going to leave.
I love it.
And it's, you get acclimated and you meet the people and you fall in love and you get out of your comfort zone and you realize there's just, so much to be grateful for and so much we can do.
Yeah, and I went to Mexico by myself like 5 years ago to this little center called Entre Amigos in San Pancho. And I wanted to go by myself because I wanted to see this center. And I read about it in Costco magazine, of all places. And everyone thought I was crazy. And my one friend's like, "You can't go to Mexico. You'll be kidnapped. Oh, my God, blah, blah, blah." And I had a great time. And then it was funny because I was looking through the pictures. And in the center, they had this sign, "Bring more tourists. They taste great." Mm. And I was like, "Well, I won't be kidnapped. Maybe I'll be barbecued." Like, so it was just, but I had the best time, and I just love to do stuff like that. So, I mean, there's just not enough time to go everywhere. And,
and I really feel like because I've had these experiences with my kids, they've learned how to be safe, how to not take stupid risks, how to see the world differently, how to be open to new experiences. And one year we went down, and the night before we were supposed to leave, the president of the country, there was a coup. Oh. This is Zaleha, and he was taken out in his pajamas, he and his wife, from his home in Tegucigalpa. And wasn't even clear that the airplanes were going to run the next day. And so we thought, well, we'll just get on the plane, we'll go to Miami, and we'll look at the news, and if things are bad once we get to Miami, we'll turn around. So we're in the Miami airport, and we're watching him on the news being taken out and, the country coming into a military rule. And we thought, well, let's still go. We'll be in San Pedro Sula. We're 2 hours away. We'll be fine.
Wow.
And we get to San Pedro Sula, and the country is basically in lockdown, and we're under curfew. So we're staying in the home, and we're watching in Honduras. We're watching the Honduran newspaper and the news, and my Spanish isn't great, but I could follow a little. And they're telling one story. And then on our laptops, we're watching CNN. And CNN is reporting a completely different story.
Of course, right? Yeah.
And there was a history lesson, right in the making. And I thought, when else are we going to get this? And then eventually, we were there a week, and eventually the consulate said, "You need to leave the country now."
Yeah.
And we were fine, but it was exciting.
Wow, that is exciting.
Yeah.
That is incredible. Wow. I mean, right in the thick of it there. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, that would make me nervous a little bit, I have to admit. So, what other nuggets of wisdom can you give us just about anybody, again, who's thinking of,
I think what I've learned about good fundraisers and, people who do well in this profession is that they're authentic and they're honest. And they listen really well. It's not about them. They're really into drawing other people out. And they're figuring out, what does this person want to do with their philanthropy? What are they really eager to do? And how can we match that with the institution's needs and come together in this wonderful project and really build stakeholders for the future? And that it's really about focusing on the relationship and not on the money. When you chase the money, you chase the gift. It's really the worst kind of fundraising. But when you think long-term about building a relationship with this donor or this family or this individual, that's where the best magic happens. Mm-hmm. And I have many times had to say to a donor, "I'm sorry, we can't make that happen. I know you wanted it to go this way. The organization's not prepared to do that. But let's find a way. Let's stay in conversation, and let's find a way to make this happen."
Yeah, honesty, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you've had so many great success stories and good advice. Do you have any kind of uh-oh moments, either through yourself or through, you know, like a lesson in what not to do? That, because those are the ones we really learned from, right? So, I mean, can you think of anything where it was just kind of like
I'm sure I've had many.
And I'm throwing
it
at you.
No, that's okay. I think there were a couple of times when I rushed a situation to try and make the ask. I didn't really take the time to get all the information and all the considerations. So I remember one instance where I was working with a father and his philanthropy, and I didn't spend enough time engaging the mother and the wife.
Mm.
And in the end, they walked away from the gift because she felt like she had really not had a voice at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real interesting lesson. And,
right, you got to know who the decision maker is, or who the group of decision makers are, right?
Exactly.
Who's involved?
Yeah,
yeah.
And I remember that one. I felt badly about that.
Yeah, I mean, well, you live and learn. Well, and I remember from like the interviewing days in business school and stuff, they were saying that they told the story of the guy came in and there was a woman, you know, mm-hmm. a woman there first, and she had taken her jacket off and she was mm-hmm. just sitting there. And the kid treated her like just some random secretary that was organizing whatever. And then when he went to the guy to interview, mm-hmm. you know, he turned on his charm and everything. But they were both equal peers in assessing who was going to be hired. And so he got in it, you know, because he just assumed.
And I've learned you got to have fun with it. You got to have humor. You've got to, you know, connect with people. I had a donor at Penn who wanted to transform what was a parking lot in the center of Penn, right in front of the Penn Museum and the Penn Hospital, into a green park. And he wanted to do this, and it was a long, engaged process because the land was owned by, you know, the hospital, by the university, and it was, anyway. And he wanted it to be permanent. The university promised it would permanently be a park, and you know, who knows, and so all of these things. So we had to say no so many times, and he just got so frustrated, but he kept coming back. So finally, we had the whole thing sewn up, and he discovered that at this parking lot, there were food trucks. And he said, well, you've got to remove the food trucks. Like, there can't be any food trucks around my park. And I said, well, that's not going to happen.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, the food trucks are really popular, and people are going to eat at the food truck and go into your park.
Yeah.
And so I called him up, and I said, come on, Ed, we're gonna have lunch on me. And we went to four different food trucks. And we went and sat down on a bench, and we tried the different food, and we just watched the people, you know, lined up, you know, 20 deep for these food trucks. And he said, oh, this could be really fun. I get it now.
Oh, my gosh, that's awesome.
I know.
Well, you just don't, you know, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
So that's incredible. So, well, I'm definitely very excited to learn, I mean, that all that you've talked about and all that we've learned. And I did want to ask, so when you went to Austin, so I went to UT mm-hmm. Austin, and you chaired the conference there a couple of years ago. So were there food trucks in Austin? I'm sure there's a lot of good food.
I loved Austin. I am dying to go back.
Yeah,
I'm dying to
go
back. My nephew lives there, and he was supposed to have a wedding this Memorial Day, but it got postponed, and so we're headed back in September. What a great, great city.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
It's a great, a
lot of university's incredible.
Yeah, and they just started a medical school last couple of years.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, they're building a medical school.
Yeah.
So they've got somebody doing the capital campaign there.
And they've got a very sophisticated development office.
Oh yeah.
And the music program's incredible. And
I had a blast.
In fact, I'm glad you brought that up because they have a course, and I got the professor to come talk to us on nonprofit management, and they have a whole degree on this, and they've gotten a donor to underwrite it all.
I might have to go back.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going back to school in Austin. All right, well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole. This was so much fun.
USA Radio News with Lance Pry.
President Biden said Tuesday that writing off $50,000 in student debt is not something he believes can be done with a presidential action, but said he's prepared to eliminate $10,000 for students. More than 42 million Americans now hold federal student loans amounting to a combined $1.5 trillion, according to Education Department data. The Biden administration seeks to end the Trump-era Migrant Protection Protocols program. The Biden administration will begin processing cases of certain eligible asylum seekers starting Friday. The White House said individuals should not take any action at this time and should remain where they are to await further instructions. Bitcoin is a digital or virtual currency created in 2009 that uses peer-to-peer technology to facilitate instant payments. For the first time Tuesday, one Bitcoin equals over 50,000 U.S. dollars. This is USA Radio News.
Balance of Nature's fruits and vegetables in a capsule, changing the world one life at a time.
You guys, your customer service and everything, you guys are great. And the commercials talk about it, but I don't know if it really gives it true justice. People need to know. This is maybe the most amazing product I've ever tried. It's so pure. It tastes so good. I'm just blown away by it.
Balance of Nature is now offering 35% off on any new preferred order. Go to balanceofnature.com today and use discount code USA.
The MyPillow Premium Pillow Special continues at MyPillow.com. If you go to MyPillow.com, click on the Radio Listener Special, use my promo code USA, you can get a standard or queen-size premium MyPillow for $29.98. That's a $40 savings. King-size, only $5 more. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the Radio Listener Square, use my promo code USA, or call 1-800-951-8175.
As millions of people across the United States continue to weather a deadly winter storm without power, forecasts predict ice and low temperatures could be ahead for some in the worst-hit states. Up to a half inch of ice will be possible over the next 3 days for areas from Texas to Mississippi and up through Virginia, according to the National Weather Service. All severe weather hazards will be possible, including tornadoes, from the Florida Panhandle to the coastal Carolinas Thursday. The CDC said Tuesday winter storms are likely to cause widespread delays in COVID-19 vaccine shipments. CDC spokesperson Jasmine Reed said shipping partners are working to deliver vaccines where possible, but the adverse weather is expected to continue to impact shipments out of FedEx's facilities in Memphis, Tennessee, as well as the UPS facility in Louisville, Kentucky. A confused President Biden told a CNN town hall audience Tuesday,